Good morning, and welcome to another in our Ag and Uncertain Times webinar series. I'm John Newkirk. I'm an extension economist and the director of the WSU Western Center for Risk Management Education. I'm a part of a team from a set of universities around the West and the Center for Farm Financial Management at the University of Minnesota that is responsible for planning and implementing this this webinar series, and it's been one of the great experiences in my career of working with this group as we've worked to pull this together. Our series is designed to help producers and others meet the challenge of today's uncertain economy. And this morning, we've got two very good speakers in our series of operating in the face of uncertain markets, dealing with marketing strategies for niche and alternative markets. The process for the morning is there are two presenters. There will be time for questions after each presentation, and we really are looking for you to supply questions for them by using the chat pod over here at the left, which I will say just a bit more about in a minute. And today we have Rod Sharp from Colorado State University and Russ Tronstad from the University of Arizona. I've had the privilege of working and observing the work of these two individuals for a number of years, and I guess quiet excellence would be my own personal description of their work. As they say, still waters run very deep. In the chat window, which is where we'd like you to enter your questions to them. If you're having some technical problem with your audio or whatever, you can type that in over here as well. But if you type in your questions into that little narrow box at the bottom, and when you're done typing, click on that button at the right that looks like a return arrow, and our team, there's a team, part of that team that you saw on that earlier slide is functioning here in the background. They pull that all together and put it in a place where I can see those questions, and I will give them then to Russ or Rod as is appropriate. And if it's a technical issue, usually one of the team will get back to you privately on the side, try to work it out. And we've been able to work out most of the issues. Occasionally, the bandwidth at wherever the person's computer has been has created some issues. But in general, we've, for the most part, been able to make it work. Unfortunately, the technology is not perfect yet. It's getting better, and we're learning to use it much better. If you joined us for one of our early webinars and are now joining us for a later one, I think you'll observe that we've gotten a bit better in terms of managing it as well. All of our past webinars, and we had four in June, and this is the third one of our September series. The four in June were on credit issues and some excellent presentations there. Actually, the lenders were pointed to some things which are beginning to work themselves out in the lending marketplace today, and so there's some really excellent information there. But you can go to our Ag and Uncertain Times webpage, and you click on the webinars tab, which you see up there in the little red box, and you can watch those past webinars. Each presentation has been split out separately, or you can watch the whole thing. You're also able to get at the slide sets of each of our individual speakers. So what's coming next? Next Wednesday, we have two other excellent presenters. We have Don Thilmany from Colorado State University, again focusing on alternative markets, and Raleigh Curtis, who is the past general manager and still an employee of Mid-Columbia Producers, giving us some really neat insights on in the commodity marketing area. And then in October, our whole series is on families facing uncertainty in ag, and we've got just an outstanding group of presenters who have agreed to work with us on that program. Another resource that's out there is the MITNET, Managing in Tough Times, an e-extension effort. And these materials that we have will also get posted up there as well. And here's just, if you want to watch this in full screen, you click on the full screen button, and your slide set, the slides go to the full screen. And if you want to reduce it back down so you can enter something in the chat window, just click on that button again. So we, at a couple times, maybe it's three, I'm getting old, I can't always remember, have polling questions for you. And those who've been with us before have been through this. Our audience changes every webinar, so please bear with us if you've answered these. It's very easy. Just very quickly run your cursor up over the answer that fits you and click on it. We get you all to respond very quickly. Then we're able to move on through these polling questions. At the end, in between our speakers and at the end, the questions will pop up, and it helps us as we think about the future series. We have the series coming up in October on families. November, we're going to deal all about dealing with risk. And then our December series, we're going to try to wrap this all up together, help folks think about working with ranch and farm families. If the forecasters were anywhere near correct, the next year or two may not be very good ones for agriculture. So, and our goal here is to provide ag professionals with resources that they can use. So in this one, if you just please click on it, tell us a bit about yourself. It helps us. There are now, and the number keeps growing here this morning, there are more than 60 of you on with us today, which we appreciate your joining us. You can tell others about the webinar because they can go back, and if you think these are good, you can. Others can still view them because they're up there on the web. And if you'd like to use these in your own programs, if you'll contact us at westrme@wsu.edu and tell us which ones you want, we'd be glad to make you a CD and send it to you, or you can just download them. And several of these presentations would make great standalone parts of a presentation, and we're really hopeful that you can make use of those. They're there to use. We want you to use them. That's why they're here. So, Russ Tronstedt is at the University of Arizona, and is an outreach professor and extension specialist in the Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics. He was raised on a ranch in rural Montana, and from working with Russ, it is true, you can take the man out of Montana, but you can't take Montana out of the man. So And we're pleased about that. Some of us have a special place in our heart for Montana. But he was on a cattle and grain ranch that had both irrigated and dry land acreage. And Russ's excellence has been recognized. He's received a number of awards and is presently specializing in working with small-scale specialty producers, both commercial and small-scale, in that area. His curriculums he's developed, Western Profiles of Innovative Agricultural Markets, examples of direct marketing and agritourism enterprises, so he's well qualified this morning to talk to us. So, Russ, it's yours.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here, and I just hope that I can keep everyone engaged here. It's hard to imagine what everybody's looking at and what everybody's doing out there without an audience here, but I can tell by the attendee list that there's obviously a lot of people there that are very qualified to also talk on this subject, and I'm sure I could learn a lot from everybody in the audience as well. But just to give a little outline of some things I plan to go over here this morning or afternoon, wherever you may be, but just to talk a little bit about, you know, niche versus commodity marketing. I know yesterday, Ed and Dylan, a lot of the things that they were talking about in terms of marketing had to do with, you know, somewhat of forward pricing, kind of timing the market, you know, not necessarily hoping for the high price of the year, but having a plan to market at a good seasonal price. Whereas some of the niche marketing here that we'll look at is somewhat of a different strategy in the sense that we're trying to differentiate the products so that we're able to get a different price than the same thing that's going on with the commodity market. Obviously, third-party certification is a part of that in terms of verifying to consumers that you don't know, you know, how your product is grown and what the attributes of your products are. Organic being one of the more common third-party certification things. We'll look at that some. We'll look at some of the direct marketing trends that have been going on for agriculture and producers. And then I'm going to pull up a couple producer examples here from some producers in southeastern Arizona. Just tell some of their story a little bit in terms of how they view their niche and the way they're approaching their marketing, and just talk about some resources that are available for us as we look into this area of niche marketing. Well, I guess to start here, in terms of niche marketing, what do we kind of mean by that? I guess, usually I like to think of first and first in terms of like product, service combination. You may occur different from what industry needs providers or others are providing. You might think organic apple, at least at one point, being somewhat of a niche there. As you know, it's growing, so the niche might be disappearing. And then you find that niche by saying, well, you had a hippic operation where you also have organic apples. And so different things that you can do that make you unique from what mainstream is doing. Also, in terms of their niche, I think is focusing on the target customers. You could have a geographic area, you know, a narrow geographic area within, you know, 50 miles of your place or something. Then, if you're targeting that group, that gives you somewhat more of a niche than others, the rest of the competition around the U.S. The demographics within that area could be the ethnicity of the group. It might be even just things of like you could be targeting even like, say, children, school bus tours. I know some people in the area have found that school bus tours are a good way to get started in terms of kind of doing recreation and selling directly on your farm, because you have good control of what the audience is going to be. You know how many are going to show up when you're starting into the direct farm marketing. You open up the gates of your place, you don't know how many people are going to show up necessarily, and you might get overwhelmed. So that's one way I think some people have gotten into kind of starting in on a smaller scale with some of the school bus tours. So in essence here, then, you want kind of a combination of your product service attributes and your customer profiles that is somewhat unique that defines your market niche. So within that, I guess we look at what are some of the challenges here for this niche marketing approach. And probably one of the first challenges would be just to find a market segment that is, you know, small enough that mainstream has kind of overlooked it, but yet also large enough to be profitable. If it's a real small market, I mean, it's going to be hard for you to create enough volume and economies of size to, you know, make it viable for your business. Next, I guess I think important to keep in mind with niche marketing is that the repeat customers are key for it. Because it's a small market, you want to be sure you've got these target customers coming back to you. So you want to pay attention to your repeat customers. And also, if you're in part of a growing market, that is helpful, because it is a small market. If the base is growing, that's going to help you in terms of being successful with your niche marketing. And probably one of the, I think, most important things to think of in terms of a niche market is, you know, why have others not already taken advantage of your identified niche market? If you've found this, what you think is going to be a new niche, how come, you know, ask yourself, how come somebody hasn't already gone out there and taken advantage of this niche? And that's where your uniqueness can fill in that void and say, I have certain attributes on my place that nobody else has, whether they might be cost advantages or different locational advantages, or even just your farm story, with sometimes in terms of your heritage that belongs to your place that you can sell that nobody else can sell. And to kind of put this into a graphical perspective here, I guess if we think of in terms of the two areas where ag is growing, we think of it being over here with where we have our large-scale commodity growers over here, where we have a farm size that's very large, and they're producing essentially a homogeneous product, like commodity. And this, you know, fits in with the area where Dylan and Ed were talking about yesterday with some of the livestock marketing and grain marketing. This area is growing here, these large producers. Also, there tends to be growing in agriculture here in terms of the smaller producers to mid-size that are producing a differentiated product here, and be it value-added activities or tourism or different things that they provide with their product to differentiate themselves from the mainstream producers. And I guess if we look at how people do get sometimes set apart, if you don't know your consumer and you're trying to reach out to a broad audience, labels, third-party certified labels are one way that you can kind of reach out to these consumers and set yourself apart from the competition. You can just look here, Fair Trade Certified here. That's a logo that you'll often see out in the grocery store, whatnot, on how the product has been grown in a way that it's fair to labor practices. You can also think of in terms of being friendly to animals. The certified humane, so that it's been raised in a way that's been favorable to animal treatment. So these are attributes we would call credence attributes, in the sense that you can't verify this by looking at the product or actually consuming the product, but they can only be verified in terms of the production process. So there, and also you think of our kosher labels and whatnot. These are things that are gaining in popularity, actually, and not just so much for religious reasons, but also for in terms of food safety reasons, in terms of believing that the process has gone through more scrutiny as it's being refined and processed. So these are one way that people have used to distinguish themselves from the competition and certification. And we've got a publication that we worked on with others in the Western Extension Marketing Committee here, called the Certification and Labeling Considerations for Agricultural Producers. And one of the diagrams that I like in there, in terms of in this publication, is Gene Kinsey's Hierarchy of Consumers' Food Preferences here. And just to note that as incomes have increased, there's a certain portion of individuals across the U.S. in particular here that have moved beyond just paying for convenience and affordable and whatnot, and they're actually willing to pay for things related to status and causes, which would be like animal welfare, growing food that's better for the environment in some cases, the argument given for organic. So in addition to just the health of the own individual, there can be other attributes that are brought in there that people are willing to pay for, and certification is a part of that. So I put this up as kind of a resource for further reading that you could look into in terms of looking at ways to differentiate yourself and make a market niche. If we move on here to organics being one of the most popular programs, I guess, for third-party certification and verification, if we look at here kind of the market penetration here of organics from 1997 up through last year, 2008, you can see that organic in terms of dollars of food sales has gone from, about 0.8%, less than 1%, up to around 3.5%. So organics has been growing, and it's still been growing at a not as fast as it was in recent years, but from the basic numbers I can find here, we're still growing is at a double digit rate here. And even in spite of the kind of the downturn of the economy, there is still appears to be growth going on in terms of the organic market here. And if we were to look at in terms of kind of the breakdown here in terms of organic food sales, you can see that the fruit and vegetable categories here, the green up here tends to be the largest, and the green here is about roughly around 37% here in 2008. Next online we would have our dairy here, which is around about 16%, and then 13% here for some of our packaged and prepared, and breads and grains here being about 10%, and then on down here where you have about 5%, and then meat just only around 3% or so. But even though some of these categories are small down here, there's a fair bit of evidence that they're growing quite a bit as well during this time. So the other question is, I guess, what is the organic price premiums? These are things that I think vary a lot by product and by season. But when you're thinking of your market niche, what is it that you might be able to grow at a certain time period in a certain window where you can outcompete others in your area and maybe a broader scale as well, is something to keep in mind. You can see from, you can go to the Rodale Institute here, and there's one site that has some information here on current organic prices. And if we were to pull up and look at some of the things they might have here for fruit, you can see this gives a list of what they have in terms of the certified here organic, and then also the conventional, and over here for vegetables, certified and conventional. And you can see the price premium varies quite a bit. And even in some cases here, like if we look down here towards our green cabbage, we can see that they have for the same weight here, conventional a little bit higher price than certified. So, that's one of the risks to growing organically, is that you may not always get that high price premium. And I know some growers have said that they always wind up moving some of their organic into the conventional market just to move enough of the volume that they have. So you might not necessarily count on getting a price premium for everything that's grown organically. When we think of our niche here through direct marketing, I guess locavore probably comes to mind here. I guess this is kind of a new word that was out. I guess the New Oxford American Dictionary had it as the word of the year here in 2007, but it's a term that kind of originated in the San Francisco Bay Area. But in terms of being a person that seeks out the locally produced food there, And not only does it involve nutrition in terms of being better and, you know, locally for a better taste, but also kind of driven behind a locavore is someone who seeks to kind of like minimize the carbon footprint of the food that they consume so that they're minimizing kind of the impact here to the environment. The other thing I think of in terms of direct marketing is that there is also tends to be a really close connection of the consumer with the grower. It's kind of filling the gap there in terms of having a consumer that goes down to the grocery store and just picks their, you know, product off the shelf and puts it in the grocery bag. They don't really have a connection with where it's grown or anything. And that kind of goes back to the customer intimacy approach in terms of differentiating themselves with that consumer. Also, I think there's a lot of consumers that recognize that they, if they can support their local community environment and sometimes even the open space of the farm, that's something that they're willing to help support. And even some consumers would say, you know, that they feel that they're, when they can look at that producer in the eye and see where their food's coming from and know kind of the credibility of that grower, that they feel better about their food than just going into the regular supermarket and thinking, well, this came from a factory farm or something, and not knowing exactly what may be behind some of the safety issues of the food there. So when we look at direct farm marketing in terms of kind of trends where we've been going, I just thought I'd pull up here the Ag Census definition. And basically, the Ag Census here defines in 2007, for their 2007 census, did you produce, raise, or grow any crops, livestock, poultry, or ag products that were sold directly to individual consumers for human consumption? So you can see it includes the roadside stands, you know, pick your own, door-to-door, but it excludes things like, you know, processed items that might be jellies, jams, and hams. So in looking at what the value of their direct sales was, if we look at our Ag Census numbers here, we can see in terms of looking at all farms from 1997 here up through 2007 over here, that all farms here have essentially been about flat. They've actually decreased just a little bit. But farms that have actually been doing direct marketing or selling some directly to consumers for final end consumption there, it's increased about 2% annually here. So you can see they've grown from about 5% of all farms that do direct marketing to upwards of around 6.2%. And we look at farm sales, we can see that, you know, all farm sales have increased, you know, just a little bit above inflation over this period from 1997 to 2007. But direct farm marketing here sales have increased annually at, you know, over 7% here, you know, above inflation. And you can see just in terms of the amount of sales, it's still very small, you know, going from like 0.3% up to 0.41% of total sales. That's still a small percentage, but the growth is there. So, I mean, I think this is falls under the definition here of what we would call a niche market here. Now I'd pull you to a couple examples here, hopefully a little bit more interesting here, that are over here in the corner here of southeastern Arizona here, to look at some of the things that they've been involved with in what I would call some of the niche markets that they've worked on to develop. The first one here I'll look at is Apollani's Orchard here. And they kind of have an interesting story in the sense that when they looked to get into growing apples in the mid-80s here, they thought, you know, that they were going to, they apparently listened to the ag economists around, and they thought that they were going to make so much money they're going to need a truck to haul all their money. But what actually happened is when they took their apples, sold them to the packing shed the first year, the packing shed sent them a bill because the cost of the picking was more than the value of what they had for their apples. So they reevaluate and say, we got to do something differently here. So they got into the business of direct marketing, not necessarily by choice, but in some sense just by survival. And as time went on, they were growing their business with their orchard in terms of their apples and pears and whatnot. They were marketing. There was another farm not too many miles away in the same area there that was also doing on the produce side a lot of vegetables that he was marketing directly. And when he put his farm up for sale, they realized that they needed to keep that farm and going because they had a lot of complementariness going and synergies between people coming out from the Tucson area going to, you know, this area to do some U-pick and whatnot. And they felt that if they didn't have this complementarity with their produce side, that they were going to be at risk in terms of vulnerability for the growth of their operation. So they went ahead and bought that operation. And you can see this is a sign at their produce farm there, Apollonius Produce and Pumpkins, where they have both U-pick and We-pick. So they have both commodities there available that you can have, and then they label things out in the field so that, you know, the consumers can have an idea exactly what they're picking and where they're at. If you look at just some of the experiences and things that they have there, they've got, Apple Barn, they call, and then it's right next to this area here where you can have picnic tables under their peach trees. They've got, kettle corn, homemade ice cream. And another thing they've added recently was a fudge kitchen. One thing, in listening to their story, you find that they've kind of shifted their kitchen from cider to actually fudge because of, just the economics associated with the situation. They weren't making much on the cider, and some of the other people they were in touch with across the country told them that fudge was a good gamble there, a good thing to do, so they got into some of the fudge, if you can believe it. They also do several value-added products here, and this allows them, I think, to minimize some of their risk in terms of just always having things ready there for the fresh. I know the U-pick is an important thing, and they usually always buy oftentimes their apples and things for their value-added products. They face certain risk though with the U-pick side in the sense of weather. I know one year they were pretty much rained out the whole month of October on all the weekends, and that was something that they remembered for a long time. And having some of these value-added products allows them to get different things into some of the stores, and also these are gift items in particular that a lot of people will buy locally for gifts for even Christmas time. A next farm here we'll take a look at. It's just down the road, actually, a little bit. And this is Briggs and Eggers Orchard. They have about a 400-acre orchard. They're larger scale, larger size than the Apollonius Orchard. They began, doing things organically in about the 90s there. And one of the things that they've had to work with in terms of being organically is develop a lot of the technology associated with the apple coddling moth. They've been involved with getting things so that mating disruption and a lot of that stuff, they've been kind of some of the pioneers in some of this area, so that part of their niche just comes back in terms of their cost efficiencies. And that comes back also, I think, in terms of their strategy to the future as well. They, really tout, freshness as being something that they have that others do not have. And of course they, say getting that fruit in there within 48 hours is what they're after. And that's, their fruit does look good. The other thing they do is they also market a lot of their product here with New Harvest Organics. If you look here at this picture here, this is a picture of Briggs and Eggers Orchard and Mount Graham in the background. And they have kind of a real positive synergies here with their marketing outlet and their production. But the other thing that I'd like to note is that they also have a fruit stand here on their place. And they, at this fruit stand here, they also not only sell to people directly here, but they also sell to what Lance Eggers would call some of their peddlers, the people that take their product to the farmers markets and locally. And what's interesting about this is they say that in about 1995, he said they really didn't have hardly any market for this here. They were just kind of getting started. But today it's about 10% of their market. And he's really glad in a sense because as Washington State's come on with a lot of organic apples and competition and stuff, he said this market here, this local market, is something that's been paid them, held up well in terms of both the price and volume. And something that they're interested in growing with. So I think, you know, when you think of some of the niche marketing considerations, I think, you know, the local consumer aspect in having a reliable market is something to keep in mind. They can minimize some of the risks that you might face from some of the outside competition. And in this case, when you think of, you know, Apple's in southeastern Arizona, they're not even on the map compared to Washington State. So, I mean, he can compete effectively with them on the location. Cost efficiencies and good records. I mean, I think both of these operations are very much in terms of aware of what their bottom line is for all of these operations. And, you know, as the organic competition increased there, Lance would just say that they need to be organic, and they're going to continue on that front because they have to differentiate their product. And basically, he's looking at ways that he can cut costs down to outcompete others, people that are getting into organics. Apple Annie's, they essentially grow their apples organically, except for the fact that in their orchard, that people don't like weeds. So they do spray Roundup. And otherwise, if he could find a way to economically control his weeds, he said he would do certified organically. But he just can't find a way that he can do the weed control as effectively. And then, but he also markets directly, and consumers, they know in terms of, you know, the pesticides are not used, and that's important for his customers. The other thing I think is important to consider is the people skills here. Not only is it people skills for dealing with labor, because as you move away from commodity to more niche marketing, I think you just can't do everything all yourself. You have to be able to have labor that you can manage and rely on. Also, you have to be able to manage people on your farm in terms of people, if you're doing any UPIC or anything like that. That's something very important to be able to do, to assess your people skills as to whether this is something you can do, because a lot of commodity marketers, I don't think, have the personality to fit in with some of the direct marketing that goes on. Also, just think of, not only is your products being complementary with each other and what's on your farm, what kind of things is unique to your farm, but also, you know, is it complementary with other producers in the area? And some of the things in the Western profiles that we found was a lot of producers that were able to team up successfully with others with similar goals and whatnot were important. I know even one case here in Tucson, there's a direct marketer of beef teamed with another direct marketer of beef because they don't want to spend all their time at the farmer's market, and they have a similar philosophy. So that has worked together there. And this is something here that John Newkirk here, or not John, but John Eichard has noted here, in the sense that your uniqueness is the only source of kind of your profitability that cannot be competed away. And it's just the sustainable part of having a niche market. And I think that's a good piece of advice to keep in mind, that your uniqueness here is what you're really selling for the long term. I just mentioned a few of these resources here with the Western Extension Marketing Committee been involved with, niche markets here, the Western profiles, and this certification and labeling considerations. If you go to valueaddedag.org, you can download these publications for free. There's also a lot of other resources out there in terms of, if we look at USDA, they have quite a bit of data here on organics. There's the National Organic Program, a lot in terms of the standards there. ATRA here with NCAT, they have a lot of resources here available here on organics. The USDA Process Verified is a fairly new system here. The Never Ever 3 applies to a lot of livestock products in particular, but with no antibiotics or growth promotants or any animal byproducts, that's something there. Eat Wild, these bottom three here are kind of online sites for getting recognition from your site and recognition from some of the local consumers. And with that, that's everything I have, and look forward to questions that may follow later.
Russ, thank you. Don't go away. We got a couple questions for you while we query the audience. And thank you for excellent information. We've actually had suggestion about the weed control issues. Someone said for weed control, they could apply some of the practice from and Bynes and Ovines, vineyard weed control project that uses sheep trained not to eat the grapevines. And actually, the sheep have been trained using lithium chloride as for aversion training. And another participant wanted you to possibly distinguish between wholesale prices. And they were making the point that wholesale prices are sale prices, not necessarily the prices paid to growers, although you want to comment on that just a little? And then I've got one other question for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I mean, they're not the price paid to growers, but I guess we'd hope that some of the premium there would also reflect back down to the grower. But it's true, it's not necessarily, yeah. On the weed control side, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's possible, yeah, you might be able to do some things with sheep and goats and whatnot. I know Eggers, they do a lot of weed whackers, basically, for their weed control. You know, I guess the difficulty with having animals out there as well, then you have another enterprise to try and manage, and, you know, not necessarily all the weeds are 100% are gone. So that's one of the difficulties, trying to find a product that you can get, you know, 100%, essentially 100% control. Yeah.
One of our audience says third-party certification can be expensive for smallholders in specialty crops and organic. Got any suggestions on how they can handle that obstacle?
Yeah, I'd agree. And but there is the program now being offered through some of the departments of ag for a cost share on reimbursement of organic certification. Usually it's up to, you know, a cost share up to like 50%, up to, I think it's like $750 now or something like that. And there is also some EQIP money is available in certain areas for transition to organic assistance, although, you know, as to how much people are going to actually be able to get out of that, it's supposedly up to, you know, like $20,000 or something over time, or more than that. But, you know, I think the total amount one would realistically expect to get would be less than that. But, you know, definitely, I mean, it's not necessarily like the price premium there comes for free. I mean, you got to be able to go through the certification process, and I think that's one of the things, you know, where Briggs & Eggers feel that they have a competitive advantage. They know how to do that. They know where their costs are and where they can cut in order to still be competitive by meeting those requirements.
Questions keep flowing in for you, Russ, which we'll get to later. We're gonna give you a chance to answer one last question here, and we'll get back to the other questions that folks are entering. Really, thank you for doing that. They're strong questions. We'll come back to those. But I think you referenced a Rodale site where the premium prices for organic, the comparison to premium to organic and non-organic was put. Was that a Rodale site?
Yeah.
And I think if you just Google Rodale, R-O-D-A-L-E, you can work your way to that site. Would that be the suggestion? The other thing is they can review your slide set, which is up on our Ag and Uncertain Times website as well. Thanks, Russ. Stick around. We'll have time for some other questions. Now we're going to turn to Rod Sharp, who's going to look at the feasibility of alternative enterprises and give us some hints and helps on how you evaluate those. And Rod is an agriculture and business management economist at Colorado State University Extension. Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics, and I believe is located in the Grand Junction area of Colorado. And he's responsible for educational efforts on the issues of farm management and risk management, business and enterprise analysis, and the feasibility analysis of alternative enterprises. And I've worked with Rod for several years now. He also happens to serve as a member of our advisory council on the Western Center for Risk Management Education, and does excellent work and has been recognized for that throughout his career. He was raised on a cattle and sheep ranch in northeastern Colorado, so he has firsthand experience in agriculture. So, Rod, without further ado, it's the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, John. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank John and the rest of his team for allowing me to be a part of this effort. I think it's a great thing that they got going on here with these webinar seminars and covering a lot of great topics. Today, I was asked to talk about the feasibility. Are you able to hear me?
Rod, excuse me. Yeah, can you put your mic just a little closer to your mouth and speak up, maybe? I mean, we can hear you, but I think we'll hear you better. Thanks. I won't interrupt again.
That's fine. Does that sound better? Is that better?
Better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get right into it. What do I mean by when I talk about an agricultural enterprises? Well, basically what we're talking about is a production activity that generates saleable products. For example, a sheep enterprise would produce pounds of lamb or wool to sell. A wheat enterprise would produce bushels of wheat and perhaps tons of straw to sell. These enterprises are really the profit centers or the building blocks of your farm or ranch business. What's some unique traits of agricultural enterprises is that your selected mix of agricultural enterprises will utilize the resources that are available to you on your farm, your land, your labor, your capital, and even your management skills to generate monetary returns. Enterprise returns and expenses specific to each enterprise can be separated from other enterprises to provide an estimate of profitability. These enterprise accounts are an important source of information, and the analysis is a powerful tool. I'm sure that most people that have heard of enterprise budgeting or enterprise analysis, because those are very strong management tools. Yeah. And like all venues in life, each enterprise has its own risks to consider. If managers are to have any chance for profits, they must take on some risk. Consequently, managers must choose from among risky enterprises in their quest for profits. Enterprise selection will determine if you reach your goals. There are enterprises that will help you reach your goals and other enterprises that would be a burden on reaching your goals that may be losers or lose money every year. Through planning and analysis and using economic tools, you can choose which combination of enterprises that will generate the greatest opportunities to be successful. So now what do I mean when I talk about an alternative enterprise? Those of you like Russ and I have for many years that have worked with alternative enterprises or value-added enterprises know that you can have a variety of meanings, and I'm going to discuss a few of those here this morning. But basically it means doing something a little bit different than you traditionally do or have done in the past. For example, it can mean raising or producing different or alternative livestock and crop enterprises. Raising and selling elk would be an alternative livestock enterprise for a traditional beef cow calf producer, for example. Or growing and selling a new seed crop would be an alternative crop enterprise for a farmer that traditionally grows corn and alfalfa hay. Here is a list here that I prepared that is a small sample of potential alternative enterprises for crop and livestock enterprises. I think it's important to remember that a new and alternative crop for one producer may be a traditional or common crop for another. Agritourism is a growing industry in the United States and presents a number of opportunities for agricultural producers. In general, agritourism is a practice of attracting travelers or visitors to an area or areas used primarily for agricultural purposes. This slide presents a list of some ideas for agritourism opportunities which could be implemented. They range from seasonal to year-round activities. These enterprises are highly consumer-focused and may offer additional options for diversification and adding stability to farm incomes. Opportunities in agritourism is really limited or limitless. And Russ talked a lot about this, but alternative production systems is also a form of alternative enterprises. Non-conventional cropping systems, including organic, natural, and low input. It also focuses on new uses for traditional crops, such as value-added processing, and crops grown for industrial use purposes. These alternative systems typically are developed to fill a niche market. There are a variety of alternative marketing strategies used in agriculture. These marketing strategies can turn price takers into price makers, but the added time, labor, and resources needed to perform these added functions should not be underestimated. E-commerce, for example, refers to selling products or services over the internet. It allows people to exchange goods and services immediately and with no barriers or time of distance. Any time of day or night, you could probably go online to buy almost any kind of product. A farmer's market is one in which farmers, growers, and producers from defined local area present a person to sell their own products directly to the public. You pick or pick your own is where consumers themselves harvest the fruits and products, usually at a premium price. Alliances, partnerships, and cooperatives are business organizations owned by farmers to collectively sell their products. The intentional benefit is to give farmers more power in the marketplace. Consumer-supported agriculture is a partnership between consumers and farmers in which consumers pay for farm products in advance, and farmers commit to supplying a sufficient quantity, quality, and a variety of products. This type of arrangement can be initiated by the farmer, or it can be initiated by a group of consumers. Direct sales is any marketing method whereby farmers sell their products directly to consumers, which includes some of the ones we've listed above. So why would farmers or rampers want to step out of their comfort zone and explore a new or a different alternative or alternative enterprise? Well, the reason that are probably threefold. Number one, they're probably looking to increase the profits of their operation. Number two, maybe they're looking to reduce the risk that they're experiencing. Or number three, maybe they want to better utilize the resources that they have available on their farm or ranch. Increasing the profitability of farm operation is a common goal for most producers. As you well know, there have been periods when traditional agricultural commodities have not been very profitable and maybe not even as profitable as some other sectors of our economy. Many producers are exploring new crops, alternative markets, non-conventional production systems, and other alternative enterprises to increase their economic returns. Producing an alternative enterprise may change the risk exposure of the operation. Risk cannot be eliminated, but management of risk can be defined as choosing among alternatives to reduce the effects of risk by reducing risk in the operation, transferring the risk to outside the operation, or increasing the operation's ability to handle risk or bear risk. This requires an evaluation of trade-off between changes in risk and expected returns and entrepreneurial freedom, among others. The hope is to take the right risk to reach your strategic goals. And finally, are you getting the most out of your resources you have available to you on your farm or ranch? The process of looking at alternative enterprises allows a producer to step back and assess your resources and to look at opportunities to tap underutilized resources. Livestock facilities may be an example, maybe a seasonal labor supplies you might have available, maybe some additional borrowing capacity. These are all some common examples of some resources that might be underutilized. The challenge is to find productive use for these resources that can increase the net returns of the business. Given my limited time today, I'm not going to be able to provide much depth in going through the process of analyzing the feasibility of an alternative enterprise for your own operation. But if you are considering an alternative enterprise and you're concerned about some additional risks of taking on a new enterprise in your business, then I would recommend you take the time to participate in an online course that I helped develop. It is designed to help farm managers select, plan, and evaluate new and existing business enterprises. The title of it is The Feasibility of Alternative Rural Enterprises, and it is a course that presents a step-by-step approach to defining an agricultural enterprise, setting goals, planning for success, and evaluating and managing the risks. This slide on the screen right now is a copy of an opening slide in the course. To go through the whole course would require about 2 hours, but the course is designed to allow every participant to proceed at their own pace. It operates much like a PowerPoint presentation, using slides to illustrate the content. Content includes individual assessments at the end of each lesson, as well as an interactive activity to help understanding with the concepts. It also has a professional narrator that helps guide you through the lessons. To get to this course, it can be accessed through the farm management website associated with this webinar series. So if you type in farmmanagement.org, you'll get the home page, which you see in front of you. And once you get in there, if you click on the Farm Management Wiki link on the left side of the screen, it will direct you to the next page here. And once in the Wiki page, kind of in the middle of the page, under number 2, it says Outline. If you click on that, and then followed by Online Courses on the next page, then you'll get a list of online courses of which the feasibility of alternative rural enterprises is listed here. So that's a pretty easy access to get to this course. And I want to kind of give you a little bit of feel for what the course is and how it works. The first part of the course works through a process to determine the level of interest those involved in the decision process have in an alternative enterprise. Without interest and commitment from the entire management team, the success will be greatly reduced. In this section, a variety of alternative enterprises are discussed, and using a checklist approach, each participant's level of interest is determined. This slide is an example of the checklist to rate their interest in growing some alternative crop enterprises. All enterprises identified by the group with a strong interest to pursue further then moves to the next step. In this step, the enterprise is run through a quick SWOT analysis. Strengths and weaknesses are internal factors. For instance, a strength could be that your son has special marketing expertise that we could take advantage of, or maybe the location of your business. Russ talked about the location of their Apple business as a strength. A weakness could be maybe your goods or services aren't quite as good a quality as some others around. Or maybe you have a damaged reputation for some reason. Those could be some internal weaknesses. An opportunities and threats are external factors, and an opportunity could be a new international market that's being developed that for your product. Or maybe it's a market that's been vacated locally by some other competitor. Whereas a threat could be a new competitor moved into your market, or maybe just some price wars from between competitors could be also a threat. So in the course, if the enterprise passes the SWOT test, where you think the strengths and opportunities outweigh the weaknesses and threats, then we move it on to the next step of selecting and planning for an alternative enterprise. In this section, you'll learn how to assess the personal, production, market, and economic feasibility of an alternative enterprise. First, the personal assessment is designed to determine if the proposed alternative enterprise is consistent with your personal, family, and family goals and values. Your personal and family goals must be considered because you're going to have a tough time if they don't fit within your goals. Next, the assessment will help you determine if you have the personal traits necessary to be successful. I think Russ talked about dealing with the public is a whole different issue, so you need some personal traits that are necessary. And these are often referred to as entrepreneurial traits. And finally, the personal assessment must assess your general business skills and knowledge. These skills must have to do with record keeping, financial analysis, marketing, and other business management concepts. To prepare for alternative agricultural enterprise, it is important to determine if you have the traits to be a successful entrepreneur. Starting an alternative enterprise is similar to starting a new business venture, and exploring alternative enterprises is not for everyone. These alternative enterprises may allow you to capture a larger share of the market, reach new markets, and or establish a unique identity, but it can be difficult. It may require more management, it may require more work, more investment, and even many times more risk. But there's been quite a bit of research done identifying characteristics of a successful entrepreneur, and this list of traits has been identified. Basic business skills are also helpful to ensure success in a new business activity. Based on your past experiences, you may have more skills than you think, but the skills that you need are listed here. And if you have weaknesses in here, these are areas where you can actually have people help you that have these skills. You can get training to increase your skills. But anyway, these are some skills that should be thought about before moving on further. You have an alternative enterprise idea that you work through to explore on your farm or ranch. During the production assessment, you may find that there are resource or production requirements that present major challenges to produce that enterprise, or the production risk could prevent you from reaching your financial goals. This section, the production assessment section, helps you identify the physical resources, production requirements, and potential production risk associated with your selected enterprise. In the market assessment, we look at help you review your potential market to determine if there are enough products and services can be sold to meet your financial goals. The first objective of the market assessment is to identify your customers. Russ talked a little bit about this as well. Your targeted customers are often defined by age, gender, occupation, could be defined by education, maybe address. Anyway, a lot of different demographic and customer profiles can go into your customer. Once you have identified your targeted customers, then you need to do some research to get to know your customers. The more you know about your customers' preferences and needs, the better you'll be able to meet those needs. The general market potential is the size of your targeted market, who and how many. From here, you can determine what product characteristics are important and the number and strength of your competitors. At this point, you can begin developing a short-term and long-term marketing strategy to attract customers to your products and services. And then the economic assessment. The purpose of this is to determine if the proposed alternative enterprise will be profitable and generate enough cash flow to pay expenses in a timely manner. Inadequate cash flow is probably the most common problem facing most new business ventures. Most common reasons for cash flow crunch are higher expenses or lower sales than expected. In both cases, there are suddenly more money going out of the business than coming in. Cash flow projections allow you to examine in detail all the inflows and outflows of your business. Financial analysis using budgets and statements is critically important to the success of a new business venture. These tools can be helpful to you as you understand how you're doing financially. In the course, we spend quite a bit of time on competitive advantage, and usually it comes in three types, and Russ also alluded to these as well. Number one, desirable product characteristics. Number two, maybe product distribution or location. And number three is price. Course goes into significant detail to help you determine if your product or services will have an advantage over your competitors. Without any advantage, being successful might be difficult. The results of the initial investigation process will determine if the alternative enterprise concept has the potential to be successful. And to be successful, the venture must be a viable business idea, feasible to produce, show market competitiveness and growth potential, and generate positive cash flow and be financially profitable. A detailed business plan should be developed for all selected enterprises. The business plan is a written document that demonstrates that enough products and services can be sold at a profit to become a successful business venture. Planning is an essential ingredient for any successful business. For those that have been on this webinar in the past, AgPlan was a tool described in a previous presentation and is an excellent tool to assist agricultural producers in the development of a business plan. I would recommend that if you have interest in doing something different in your business or looking at alternative enterprise, to take a look at that online course. And with that, John, I'll turn it back over to you.
Rod, first question. Is there a cost in working through that online course?
No, there is no cost.
And what do you see as the biggest hurdle to adding alternative enterprises, especially where traditional commodity production is what the manager has prior experience with?
I think the biggest hurdle probably would be on the business management side of it. A lot of people aren't used to this type of detailed analysis and calculating their break evens to the detail they need for marketing. And I think also just the dealing with the public, if they do a lot of direct marketing, would be a big hurdle, where people in agricultural are typically pretty independent and like to keep to themselves. But a lot of different challenges. It depends on your own personality and each producer's skills and abilities.
I've got a number of questions here for Rod and Russ, but I'm just going to break a second here to plug next Wednesday's presentation, which starts off with Don Thilmany from Colorado State University, who is going to provide a number of additional insights in this area of alternative markets. Her work spent a lot of time working with small farms and direct markets, so if what you've seen today strikes an interest, I encourage you to join in next week as well. That will be followed then also on Wednesday by kind of a wrap-up around the commodity marketing area by Raleigh Curtis, who has many years' experience in the grain marketing area. But back to our questions. Rod, do you have or do you know of an interactive enterprise budget online or a website?
An interactive budget for calculating?
Enterprise budget. Website, yes.
I think almost every state has some form of enterprise budgeting for different types of crop and livestock enterprises. The interactive part may not be as widespread. I know there are some states that do have interactive enterprises where they can go in and I know in our enterprises and budgets in Colorado, we have kind of what we have collected through survey information of what some numbers are, with the opportunity for the producer to enter their own information in there. And we actually encourage them to do that because a lot of the data will not represent them very well. But I would guess most states probably have some form of interactive website in order to do enterprise analysis.
Russ, one of our audience comments, it says price premium does not necessarily mean profit. Are organic growers really making a profit? And are you aware of any studies on that specifically for fruit and vegetables?
Yeah, great question. Actually, I was involved with a study on the Four Corner States. It's called the Organic Market in the Four Corner States. It was a few years ago, looking at practices in 2005. But in that survey to all the certified organic producers, we asked the question, they thought it was more profitable for them. Of course, 78%. Said they thought it was more profitable, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you could go out and it'd be more profitable for you. But at least the ones that are currently doing it, felt that it was more profitable for them. And also in terms of, why they actually grow organic, the number one reason that was selected was higher prices, and it wasn't, the belief in the organic philosophy, but it was related to price, so, and market access. So I guess there's positive indicators, at least from those that were certified organic in the Four Corner states, that higher prices and the profitability was why they were doing it.
Given the, and either one of you can jump in on this question, given increasing efforts of Walmart and other marketers to offer locally grown foods, do you think this represents a new outlet, or is it simply increasing competition for niche marketers?
Well, I mean, I think it's a lot just like the organics. I mean, organics used to just primarily be in, the natural food stores and whatnot. And now, I mean, I think that of the organic sold, about, I believe it's like 47% is sold through, what we call traditional supermarkets, including Walmart, and, another 45% or so to the specialty stores, about the same. And then the rest, organics is sold, to farmers markets, roadside stands and whatnot. So that, clearly, I mean, whenever you find a niche, it's not like you can just stay there and sit on that niche, because as that niche tends to grow, others will recognize it and work to capitalize on it. Just being local, probably is not going to be enough in the future if other supermarkets are really trying to source locally and provide that commodity or ingredient attribute as part of their food offering.
I might add a comment.
I'll
to
ask
that.
This question first. Go ahead, Rod.
I can give you an example of I have a local dairy producer that put in a cheese processing facility, and their intent is to try to use some of their own milk and process it and increase profitability through those avenues. And as they they do have a lot of direct sales from a small store right on their dairy, and some smaller farmers markets and things like that. And now they're looking at to expand their sales through retail outlets such as the Kroger retail or grocery stores and others. And so I think there's twofold. It gives them an opportunity to probably increase the number of pounds of cheese that they're able to sell, but a lot of times the profitability on those are less because of the grocery store itself trying to attract some of the profits from those. So there's some benefits on moving more product, but probably at not as profitable of a rate as some of their other avenues, if that makes sense. So.
And Rod, and then I'd like both of you, Russ, to answer this from your own experience. In your experience, are niche markets more profitable than traditional commodity production? Russ kind of dealt with that before about the organic. And the other thing is, given the uncertain and difficult economic times we find ourselves in, are these a good strategy to pursue?
Well, your question about are niche markets more profitable, there are niche markets that are more profitable, and there are niche markets that are niche production activities that are fail as well. So it really depends on the situation. I would say there are opportunities for agriculture producers to look at different markets or different alternative enterprises and determine and make sure you do the analysis or use a sharp pencil before you actually get involved. But I think there are opportunities, but that doesn't mean that all niche markets are profitable. That's my answer to the question.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, I think
Russ.
The one thing that's probably not going to work is a small scale on a commodity oriented market. I mean, you're going to have to be subsidizing your your income from something else, and some people do that as well, but you know, if they're in it for lifestyle or what have you. But I think the opportunities are definitely more there for the niche, in terms, especially on the smaller scale. And you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that necessarily a niche market is going to be profitable, as Rod is emphasizing.
Many small producers are looking at niche. The latest USDA ag census, I was surprised, and I may not have this figure exactly right, says that I think it was as high as 80% of the farms in America have off-farm income sources. And of course, these are much more critical, probably, with small producers or folks just entering. So what is some advice that you have to give to folks that are pretty dependent upon off-farm income, and how they, in terms of alternative enterprises, or these, how they think about that off-farm income in relationship to this business, ag business enterprise that they're either in or starting or changing?
Well, I might just refer to, I know, like the Apple Annie's operation that I referred to, they, you know, off-farm income was really crucial for them when they were starting. John, he was working for the Forest Service at the time, and, you know, and allowing their business to grow early on, I think that was really, really critical for their enterprise. I mean, he doesn't work there anymore, but early on, in particular, the off-farm income was really crucial for their operation.
My comment to that, John, would be, I've had a lot of experiences where the second income, which has normally come from off-farm, their desire is to have that second income come from these niche direct markets, so they can stay home, maybe be with the kids, or those kind of things. So their whole goal is to generate their second off-farm income on the farm, and so they can be home with kids during their raising their family. And so, but it's very difficult, I think, on the smaller operations, like Rush said, without off-farm income of some sort, it's very difficult to have the production and profitability to make it a viable business alone without some off-farm income.
And here's a question. The timing was such. And the question is, did they have a budget or any, and this is for Russ, did they have a budget or any economic analysis to substantiate their acceptability of making a profit, or is just a guesstimation? And I'm not sure if that was talking about Annie's Orchard or one of the other examples that you used, but I'll let you divine that, Russ. Let's say Annie's.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could say that.
Put the question to that one.
In just talking with them in general, they really do have a pretty good indicator of not just their total bottom line, but the different, what I might call, profit centers that are going on, like especially with Apple Annie's and even Eggers Orchard, in terms of, you know, their products and the markets they're going to. I know Apple Annie's, in terms of the adjustments they've made, just even within their kitchen there, you know, they do really do a good job of tracking, you know, not just what's selling, but how much money they're making off of it in terms of the help and everything else. And also, you know, with the Briggs and Eagers, I mean, they really seem to do have a good feel for their, as Rod would say, their break even and everything around related to the whole orchard and the marketing activities going on. And just to even emphasize, you know, even though 10% of direct sales is not a lot, Lance was really working in saying we need to grow that, because, I mean, as Washington State really increased a lot of their organic production, just, you know, that local market there really helped our bottom line a lot. So,
a question just came in. And Russ, I believe it was you that pointed at some interesting Ag's 2007 census. And this is a follow-up on that, I think, and it says, do you see any trend towards commodity growers dedicating some of their acreage towards growing for local or niche markets?
Well, I think that's what we're seeing. You know, I guess the ag statistics verifies as well, I mean, it's still a relatively small percentage of total farm sales, so it's not like it's, you know, something that is necessarily going to be noticeable in terms of the overall size of farm sales much, but at the present, but I do think we see a growing trend in that direction.
I know the go ahead.
I've had experience with a lot of commodity producers that are maybe not a niche market, but they're looking at alternative enterprises such as like a hunting or a fishing type of an enterprise where they're bringing in outside hunters on their property, which has significantly helped their bottom line and profitability. Some others that are have experience in training their own horses and stuff, they're actually bringing in outside horses and charging for that to train other people's horses and also training dogs for livestock. That kind of thing. And so there's a lot of, it may not be what you would consider maybe the fruit and vegetable type niche markets or farmers market type stuff, but there's a lot of alternative enterprises that people are looking at that kind of diversify their operation and also give maybe some additional income here and there to help over time.
And generally it's not a lot of acreage involved either. I mean, usually we're talking on the smaller side, on the acreage side, so...
I don't know whether we'd call it a trend or not, but here in eastern Washington, a group of growers have banded together wheat producers, about the most commodity of commodities in terms of, for the greatest in an undifferentiated product, and growing a specific hard wheat with really excellent milling qualities, and have marketed that under something called Shepherd's Grain. And economic difficulties have worked their way back into that market as well. But, I mean, there was an opportunity in an area where most people don't think about as well. So I don't know whether we would call that a trend or not. So I'd like to thank Russ and Rod very much for their very informative presentations. I'm sure that if you want to communicate with them directly, they would both accept your emails, and their information, you can find that with either the University of Arizona or Colorado State University. As I pointed out, next Wednesday morning, again, 9 a.m. Pacific, 10 Mountain, 11 Central, 12 Eastern, the wrap-up to our marketing series with Don Thilmany and Raleigh Curtis. Our October series is Families Facing Uncertainty in Agriculture. We've got an excellent group of presenters with lots of experience working with families in caught in financial distress. In November, operating in a risky environment where we'll focus in more specifically on risk management areas in all of the areas that we've touched here. And while we will deal some with crop insurance, managing risk, of course, is much greater than that. And then in December, we'll pull it all together in managing and ag enterprises. And I would... if you've missed some of the past presentations, the June ones on credit, the earlier ones on marketing this month, you can go to our Ag and Uncertain Times website. The recordings are there. The slide materials are there. List of speakers, contact information, and some discussion of webinar topics. We'd like you to provide us some input of other anything additional in the areas that came up today you'd like to see information provided on, or provided us some advice, comments. You can either do that on the chat pod at the left or send us an email at westrme@wsu.edu. We've been through the polling questions for the audience, and so this next pod that comes up, you can click on these files and follow the directions, highlight a file, click on the Save to My Computer there at the bottom, follow the instructions, and it'll download this virus-free file to your computer. It has all of these web references and sources on it, and from yesterday's presentation and also from today's presentation. And we'll leave that up a little here after we sign off on the webinar. But again, thank you all very much. Look forward to seeing you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific time. Thank you.